I'm Dream Queen. You're in the cab with me. Thank you so much for rolling. Thank you so much for joining, Helen. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
I often have people in from this community that I've known for years, that I've seen around, that I've had small chats with, and this venue has become a place to get to know folks in a deeper level. You and I sat down for coffee a few weeks ago, and I got a peek into your work and your history as a human being and the things you've done in this country. And I immediately asked you if you would come on the show and help school the people and teach us about yourself. And I just want to share you with our audience. So I'd like to ask you to introduce yourself, if you wouldn't mind. Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm a 72-year-old rebel. And I like to say I'm in the last trimester of my life, so I feel very free to say what I feel like saying. And, of course, I'm restricted on this show from using some of my favorite words, and this is going to be a very big challenge. But I come from a family that's been very politically active, very liberal. Strangely enough, this will blow some younger people's minds, but we were all Republicans because back in the day, decades and decades ago, there were many liberal Republicans. And then, of course, we all left over time and moved on. But my work is mainly involved environmental issues, animal issues, women's issues, abortion, that kind of thing. And I got a good education on legislation and the legislative process working on the Hill in Washington for the man who became my husband, who was a congressman for 15 years. And he was an environmentalist as well, co-authored the Endangered Species Act, and was also a great guy on a lot of other issues. And I saw firsthand how people can make a difference. People who might not be anybody at all. We know we had a constituent write in once when the wilderness bill was coming up for revision in Congress, and she said, I'm a backpacker in the High Sierra, and I've been looking at the bill, and I think the boundaries ought to be changed this way and that. And Pete went over to the congressman whose district that was in and said, hey, well, how do you feel about an amendment? She seems to have some pretty good points. And the other congressman was like, yeah, that looks good. And Pete offered the amendment on the House floor, and the woman's suggestion passed, all because she called up, requested a copy of the bill, read the bill, looked at the maps, cared, and made a suggestion. Of course, the key to that was she had a congressperson who was receptive to communicating with his or her constituents. And some of that has faded in today's Congress.
How did you get involved with Pete and get yourself down there in California on the Hill?
So my father was a diplomat and worked at NATO, and NATO was headquartered in Paris, and so that's where I grew up. And then when President de Gaulle of France kicked NATO out of Paris, we came back to the United States. And as it happened, that was the first year Pete was running for office. The old congressman had died unexpectedly, so they were holding a special election to fill the vacancy. And the Vietnam War was just starting. It was 1967. And Pete was a Marine colonel who'd been very highly decorated in the Korean War as a platoon leader, and he came out against the war in Vietnam way before that was a common thing. And nonetheless, he got elected to Congress in the special election. And my parents became friends of his right away when they moved back to the United States because they were political and he was, you know, an interesting guy that they supported the views of. And so I, you know, knew him when I was 14. And if anybody ever told me I'd end up marrying him, I would have thought they were freaking crazy. And we were great friends. We came out here to Madrid in 1978, I think it was. We were just bumming around New Mexico, and, you know, I totally fell in love with the area and had a very good friend over in outside of Las Vegas, New Mexico. So I started coming out here a lot.
And you fell in love with it like people do.
Yeah, absolutely.
You worked as an editor on a brief biography of New Mexico's Manuel Lujan?
Yeah, Manny Lujan was the congressman from Albuquerque for a long time. And then under Bush, he became Father Bush, not Baby Bush. He became the Secretary of the Interior. And he was just a good guy and 24th generation New Mexican, something like that, going way back. And so Pete and he were really good friends. In fact, Pete ran for the presidency in 1972 against Richard Nixon, mainly to try to drum up more debate about the Vietnam War. And so he ran in New Hampshire in the primary, and he was put on the ballot here in New Mexico by a friend of his. And he never came out here to campaign during that particular election. He was, you know, focusing on New Hampshire, but so many people voted for him in New Mexico that he got a delegate to the national convention. And the 1972 Republican National Convention would have been unanimous to reelect that idiot Richard Nixon, except for the state of New Mexico, which poor Manny Lujan had to stand up and say, the great state of New Mexico cast its 13 votes, 12 for that patriotic American Richard Nixon, and one for Pete McCloskey. Yeah. So that was the only, that was the one vote against the war at the entire convention that showed up as in the delegate count.
Wow.
Yeah. So Pete had a presence in New Mexico and loved New Mexico, and we came out here all the time and ended up, you know, buying a house here decades ago.
There's so much here that I want to talk with you about. You spending part of your time here and then the other part of you and Pete's time over in California. Can we talk briefly about the olives?
Yes, the olives.
How did you get involved with the olive?
We had a farm that we bought in 1989, and we wanted to get away from everything and be within an hour of an airport, which is mutually contradictory. And we found a valley in Northern California in a little town called Rumsey, population 30. Oh, wow. So we came to Madrid for social life. You know? 300, that's a lot. And we started farming, and the farm we bought had walnut trees on it, but they were all dying and past their lifespan. And I wanted to grow olives, and Pete wanted to grow oranges, and so we planted 600 orange trees and 600 olive trees over the years, because we didn't have a crew. We planted them.
Wow.
We planted them. And so we had oranges. And also, it's a very hot microclimate there. It's typically 100 to 110 all summer. So I said to him, we are not planting anything we have to pick in the summer. And the oranges we picked between January and April. And the olives you harvest, depending on what the trees are telling you, between like October and January. So those were winter harvests, which suited us perfectly. And then we could come here during the monsoon season, which is my favorite. And then also during the legislative session, because I like to weigh in on animal issues in the state legislature here.
And that's how I first became familiar with your name, was being on the Facebook groups and seeing your posts regarding the coyote traps.
Yes. Steel leg hole traps and trying to end the coyote killing contests.
Yes.
Which are particularly gruesome. They're all gruesome. I mean, all of that stuff is gruesome. But we had a dog who got caught in one of the steel leg hole traps on public land. And when you see it up close and personal, and the traps are nonspecific. They'll trap blue herons. They'll trap eagles. They'll trap, you know, bunnies. They'll trap your dog. They'll trap coyotes. They'll trap mountain lions or bobcats, I mean, whatever. And people make money selling furs. And, you know, you and I aren't allowed to grow a garden on federal land. And why should they be allowed to kill off all the wildlife whose home that is to make a buck selling to the fur trade in New York or Asia? Mm-hmm. It's like not happening.
The double standard in the world. So let's bring it around to human rights. I know your parents were politically active. When you came into this world as a itty-bitty baby person, did you feel the inkling to get involved in politics? Like, for me, I knew from a very young age, looking through the window of the world, i.e. the TV, because we watched the news all the time in my house, that there was a lot of injustice going on, and I felt like it was such a strange planet. The world seemed strange to me. Do you think that you had this feeling of compassion and empathy and concern that was fed by your parents?
I think I was born wanting to be naughty. Like just mischief and getting into trouble and pushing boundaries. And you know, growing up in France, it's a very interesting culture because it's stratified class-wise in many ways, but it's also incredibly egalitarian in other ways. And so, for instance, public education is federalized there. So on any given day, The lesson plan in the cow country of Alsace-Lorraine is going to be the same lesson plan as the kid in the ghetto, as the kid in the rich district. So all things else being uneven, public education is very equal there. And when you end up finishing high school, you have to pass a very difficult exam. And so I grew up with a lot of, huge varieties of people. And I like to hang out with kind of the street kids and stuff. And my parents were very lenient and very open and also very tending to hire out the function of being parents so I could get away with murder in a lot of ways. And I changed schools every year because we kept, not having our shit together. And so I had a great mix of human beings in my life, and I came to really see everybody as potential allies and friends and not have the distinctions that I think are really prevalent here in this country.
So there's two main subjects that I wanted to cover with you today. One is the letter that you brought to my attention that you wrote for the rally, the No Kings rally. Tell me more about what's behind this letter.
So when I'm in California, we had to sell our farm when Pete got sick because it was a mom and pop operation and it was becoming too much for me to run by myself. And so we moved to a little town called Winters, which is a really neat town. It's 52% Hispanic. It's on a really beautiful little river. It's in the agricultural part of California and it's in the county where our farm was. So, it was a nice fit. And on No King's Day, some friends there who were organizing the rally asked if I would write a little something for one of the people to read to the people who were attending, and so I did.
Thank you. And you sent me that letter when we were at the No Kings gathering here in Madrid. I'd love for you to read that to our audience. And the other thing that I'd like to talk about is your work with Arab-American relations.
Okay.
So let's start with the letter.
Okay. Friends and neighbors, we've all been feeling it, the sense that the very ground under our democratic republic is trembling. Deep divisions are magnified by the power of social media, words twisted, laws disregarded, basic rights eroded, and the Constitution, our foundational American document, disdained as if it were optional. But it isn't optional. It's ours. It belongs to us, not to any politician, not to any party. It begins with three simple words. We, the people. Not I, the ruler. Not we, the party. Two amendments in particular are under daily assault. And unless we defend them fiercely, proudly, together, we risk losing the very rights that made this nation a beacon of hope for generations. The First Amendment gives us the right and the duty to speak freely without intimidation. It guarantees the right to gather peacefully, unpunished, unprovoked, to support or oppose policies, and to petition our government for redress of grievances. And it protects a free press, in print, on air, and online, from censorship. It is the heartbeat of a free people. The Fourth Amendment draws a sacred boundary. Our private lives, our homes, our personal papers and possessions may not be violated by government whim. It prohibits searches and seizures without lawful, specific warrants. This amendment stands as the wall between liberty and tyranny. We are living through a time when the very ideas that built this country, truth, equality, and the rule of law, are being tested more deeply than most of us have ever seen. These tests come slowly, drip by drip, in words that twist meaning, in laws that chip away at rights, in leaders who crave power over justice and demand loyalty instead of truth. When our rights are ignored or broken, we have a duty to act. Remaining silent or withdrawing is how freedom dies, not in one grand collapse, but in 1,000 small surrenders. Never, ever believe there's nothing I can do. That is exactly what those who thrive on chaos and deception are counting on, our exhaustion, our despair. So breathe in the Constitution. It is alive, not a relic of the past, and breathe out courage. There is so much we can do. Build community, reach out to those less privileged, help young people engage and understand their power. Register voters, because the effort to restrict the vote nationwide tells you everything about how powerful it truly is. If your vote didn't matter, they wouldn't try so hard to take it away. Let's lift each other up, stay alert, and stand strong. These are perilous times, but they are our times. It's time to remember the oath we all share as citizens, to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, never to pledge allegiance to one man, no kings, ever.
Thank you for those inspiring, moving, and educational words. In your opinion, how did we get here?
Oh, it started so long ago. I mean, probably started, if you ask someone older than me, beyond my memory. But in my memory, I can tell you that it started with Ronald Reagan, with changes in the tax law that benefited the rich starting back then, with a change from what the Democrats used to do when they were in power, which is tax and spend, to the Republicans, which was reduce taxes and borrow. And now this country is $30 trillion in debt. It's continued through the various administrations with Congress giving up a lot of its power little by little in the way they handled bills that funded the government, in the way they looked away when various presidents got involved in foreign incursions, like in Iraq, you know, giving up the duty to actually declare war before we go bombing other countries. I mean, it's just been an erosion across the board. And then when Newt Gingrich was elected to the House of Representatives, he really promoted the culture of hate. There were a lot of really good Republicans and Democrats who worked really well together. And that was kind of the hallmark of the time that my husband was in Congress. Democrats and Republicans worked well together. Lots got done. All the important environmental bills, all, you know, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Marine Mammal Act, the Estuarian Act. I mean, you can go on and on. Those all passed in the 70s when the Democrats and Republicans rolled up their sleeves, made compromises. It's not a dirty word. It's how legislation evolves and moves forward, and passed incredible bills. And then Newt Gingrich came in with a highly partisan agenda, and the Republican Party had already gone sort of religious right, which is why I left. And the hardliners really took over, and a kind of a culture of hate started really taking root. And I think you add in from the social side, social media, which promotes algorithms that are made to make you reactive, made to make you have your, you know, rage fueled. And you put all these things together, and this kind of erosion of social fabric has happened. And in during, you know, Baby Bush's administration, there were bills to weaken the Clean Air Act, but it was doublespeak, so they'd call it things like the Blue Skies Initiative. You see a lot of that with Trump. Just twisting words, you know, flipping meanings, and befuddling people, and just taking away their energy in the sort of, but it's been going on, it's been eroding for a long time, and now it's kind of hit a crescendo with this current administration and the completely corrupt pay-to-play crap that's going on among all the people in the administration and the tech bros.
Right, the tech oligarchy that yes. We have going on right now.
Yes.
So let's weave in the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment. The illegal search and seizures and all these things are happening not only around the immigration issues, but around Palestine and conversations that have to do with Palestine and Israel. I want to weave these issues together because I think they're related. We're losing our freedom of speech. It's being called hate speech if we're talking about supporting Palestinian lives
and
ending genocide.
Yes.
So your background in working with the Arab American rights movements, tell me more.
So in 1979, my husband went over to the Middle East. He was a congressman, and he went by himself, not with a delegation, although he had gone with a delegation at one point of other Congress people interested in what's going on. And he met with all the leaders in all the various countries in the Middle East, including Israel and Jordan and Syria and Lebanon, and came back realizing that our foreign policy vis-a-vis Israel was completely one-sided, and that we were not an equal player, could not even play a role in promoting a peace agreement because we were completely one-sided. And interestingly enough, at the same time, Senator Chuck Percy, who was a liberal Republican from Illinois, also made a trip to the Middle East and came to the same conclusion. And then another Republican, fairly liberal congressman from Illinois, Paul Findlay, also went over to the Middle East and came to the same conclusion. So it was just a weird thing that the three of them went there, not with each other, and all came back saying, we just have a terrible policy. It's not even handed. And for that, they all were attacked by AIPAC, the big Israeli lobby, which really should be have been registered as a foreign agent lobby years and years, decades ago, but never has been. And they were all immediately branded as anti-Semitic. And this was in 1979. So this whole effort to criminalize criticism of Israel has been going on for decades, promoted by AIPAC. And AIPAC is made up of a lot of the major Jewish groups we come to think of as somewhat civil rights oriented, like the Anti-Defamation League, but it has a very dark side to it. I was part of a lawsuit again. I was a plaintiff in a lawsuit against them. They work hand in glove with the Mossad, which is Israel's secret police, which is a terrifying organization. So things are much more sort of like the novelist John le Carré. You know, if you read his books or you watch The Blacklist, one of my favorite shows, and you see how complex things are and how many dark forces that you don't see are operating. But I don't want people to ever let that make them defeatist, because people are powerful, and I see it so much, and I absolutely do not tolerate people who say you're not powerful, the system is too corrupt, and blah, blah, blah. That's just not—the system is corrupt, but you are not powerful. You are powerful.
Yeah. In the face of this powerful dark hand, how do you maintain your energy? It seems like you're pretty scrappy, right? And this, you know, I don't want to give up, but it's exhausting. And for so many decades, you've been out here fighting the good fight. Do you have any advice for those of us who are listening now that see a long road ahead to equality and freedom, and like we're backsliding? How do you stay sane?
Well, that's a question. Do I stay sane? You're making an assumption that may not be correct. I have gotten to the point where I really do have to be careful about not letting the endless onslaught of things that make you cry toxify my inner world. I love nature, and I love staring at rocks and bugs and animals, and that's something I do every day. I think timing the input of information and where you get information is really important. I sound a little bit like a right-winger. I don't watch legacy media anymore. I don't even watch MSNBC anymore, although it's a good station. For instance, if I want to watch stuff on international affairs, which I like, or on the Middle East in particular, I watch Al Jazeera on YouTube. I listen to podcasts from people I respect, and I pretty much end up listening to a little bit of sort of what the general news if I'm going to Santa Fe and I'm listening to NPR or public media station. I also sometimes torture myself by watching YouTubes and reading stuff from people whose views I strongly disagree with, just so that I'm keeping, you know, finger on the pulse of all of that. But you have to really be careful. I think we have a duty to be involved. That's kind of what it's all about. And also just spiritually, I look at it as every generation has gone through really huge challenges. We've sort of been free of that for several decades in this country. Although if you were Japanese American and you were shoved in a concentration camp in 1941, you would not say that it's been without its immense challenges. But for the most part, many of us have not experienced the kind of widespread oppression that is going on in this country. It's, you know, it's the way of the world, and I think there's a spiritual element. This may go on for our whole lives. But you know, where are you spiritually on these issues? And I take sustenance from that. I may not see the winning round in my life. I probably won't. But I want to know when I'm kicking the bucket that I stood for what I stood for and that it was for the benefit of the greater good.
I love that. This show has a spiritual bent to it. I almost feel morbid sometimes when I tell people, you better get right with your spirit, get right with great spirit, because, you know, that's really true. At the end of the day, as Jim Morrison said, no one here gets out alive, right? And we have to be okay with the time that we've spent here and go with no regrets. And to try to elevate while we're here, ourselves and each other.
Yeah.
Leave it better than you found it. And I feel like we have come really far since 1492. You know, we've grown, but now we're losing the strides that we've made toward equality. And so your call to tactical politics and voting, let's touch on that a little bit. And I'm still simmering the pots of anti-Semitism and hate speech and the rise of ICE and the neo-Gestapo that we have here. So all of this at the same time, right? We talk when you sat down. Some people say voting doesn't help, that we need to take to the streets and give them what they're giving us. What do you think that people really need to remember when it comes to voting politics?
So I remember someone telling me when I was young, and it stuck with me, that you can't tell people what to do. You have to honor where their passion lies. And I think finding where your passion lies is really important, because politics is a huge ecosystem. I happen to like the legislative process. It's slow, though. It's not for those who are super impatient. And so I was working once on an issue. I was opposing Stanford University who was building a secret animal torture chamber in its campus. They do a lot of research, which they pretend is all to find the cure for cancer, but actually a lot of it is Defense Department contracts. And so they had violated the Animal Welfare Act several times, which takes a lot of doing because it's a very lax act. And so I was opposing their trying to build an underground facility where there would be no oversight of the use of animals. And it was a legislative proceeding. It was through the county, and it was to stop building permits and stuff. But I had activists in the animal rights and animal welfare community who wanted to show up in rat suits and placards. And here's the thing. For the work that we were doing, and I was working with the Humane Society and the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition, because Stanford was also dumping radioactive animals into, you know, dumps and stuff. So it was a legislative process, and it wasn't the right place or time for the people in the rat suits, although the people in the rat suits have a place and a time. So it's an ecosystem. And I think matching people, or having people match themselves to where they're most comfortable and most effective, is very important, because if you put someone where they don't want to be, even if it's on an issue you all agree on, their energy is sapped. You need to go where you feel comfortable and where your passion is. And that's part of kind of managing a movement, I think. But sometimes it's not okay to have certain things happen in another kind of arena. So you have to kind of know the lay of the land. It's alienating in a legislative process to have a lot of disruption and cuckoo-ness. But cuckoo-ness is totally appropriate in the streets a lot of time. And I think some of the most effective action against ICE and the Gestapo bounty hunters, which, I mean, I was watching some footage my niece, who's a documentarian, just took in California 2 days ago with a guy with a tear gun thing. It looks like an AR-15, but it's to shoot tear gas. And he's doing it right in the face of a minister. And he's not in uniform. You know, he's a fat slob who's wearing a pair of khakis and a flannel shirt. He's got all of his tactical gear. These are bounty hunters. They're given big bonuses for joining up. They're not trained. They're out of shape. I can guarantee you virtually none of them have ever read the Constitution, and that would go all the way up to the current president. And they don't give a damn about anything. But mocking them is incredibly powerful. And also using your phone to videotape. I mean, there's some great YouTubes of guys that have just been in the face of men who've shown up supposedly from the FBI to discuss a post he made on social media. It's like, that is the kind of stuff where you just put your foot down. But I do think that these times are slightly dangerous, and I am concerned when people do that on their own, if there's more than one, you know, ICE type person or fake federal person or whoever. I don't encourage people to be too in their face if they're alone, especially if they're female or people of color, or any excuse where they can whisk you away.
Yeah. We were having that conversation yesterday at our breakfast meeting. Even within our groups of resistors, there are different tiers. And I was coming from exactly that point. You know, someone said, I'd fight an ICE agent. And I'm like, I don't know if I would. I mean, I have to tell you the truth. It all depends on the situation. Mm-hmm. And it is not like I'm not a fighter. It's not like I don't have a warrior background. I think that's part of what I'm scared of, is blacking out and waving my knife at some ICE agent and off in the run of everybody. You know, I have to really spend the past several years of my life thinking about de-escalation and how to not get into a fight with someone. But the point that I came up with is exactly what you said, which is I have to be sure of what my role in the movement is and not run toward danger that will compromise maybe a more important role that I have doing something else. When they are labeling Antifa, anti-fascist, person of an anti-fascist mindset, as a collective organized movement, It's not.
Such ding-dongs. Yeah. I mean, the whole point is it's not centralized. It's...
No. You know what I mean? But and this is the exact example, because we all recognize that everybody's got, you got the frog suit guys, you've got you folks who are doing street activism, and you've got journalists, and you've got podcasters, you've got everybody doing different things. And who's going to rebuild? You got the phone tree people, but it's all scattered. We just all know these roles are necessary. But if ICE comes walking down the street right now, we all run into the street and get shot, then there's nothing left. And that, I think, is exactly what they want. And with social media, I do feel very under attack as a person whose first reaction is to de-escalate. Like, I find it logical to think, how can we do this without loss of life or injury? You know, and folks are like, there's no place for nonviolence in the type of situation that we have right now.
That's such a complex and deep question. I mean, I even have mixed feelings about it. I think in the demonstrations, humor, mocking, numbers, but definitely de-escalation in terms of not weaponizing the situation. The administration wants that. You know, they want to be able to shut down the whole country. And it's so ironic, because I've heard for years right-wing Republicans say, oh, the Democrats are going to build concentration camps and the Democrats are going to take away all of our guns. And I have to laugh, because it's exactly what's happening under the Republicans. Not the taking away of guns. There's more guns in this country than there are vehicles, I think, at this point. But if they had the chance to blame some event and confiscate guns, they might do it.
Yeah.
They might do it. So de-escalation is really important. And at the same time, history does show that I have mixed feelings about the role. I don't know about the role of nonviolence. I totally get it. I think in what we're talking about, de-escalation is very important. It's very important we keep ourselves together and don't drop down to the level of violence that they want to incite, because that's what they want to incite. And at the same time, I look at liberation movements all over the world, and they have not been without weapons. I mean, even Gandhi, there was bloodshed. And I'm a gun owner, you know, so I'm a liberal gun owner, and I encourage my libtard friends to, you know, embrace their Second Amendment rights, because you don't know when you might need that tool. I hope never, you know, I totally hope never. But I think it's naive, looking at history, to think that it will be necessarily never.
Right. And I agree, and I think there's never one answer to anything. That's mm-hmm. why there are levels to an organized front, right? John Trudell comes to mind right now. There's a quote from a piece of his that I like to play. And he's like, we can't outfight them. We have to outthink them. Mm-hmm. And most of us have the benefit of free thinking, whereas the established state has what is called the chain of command, and that those folks on the street in the military are not allowed to think for themselves. They just want to follow orders. And now, to me, I feel like it's really severely called upon for the troops, the National Guards people who are out here, the cops who are out here, the judges, the litigators, to search within their conscience and break the chain of command to get back to this document, which is the Constitution, with all of its amendments that include moving toward an equitable society, and support that. And there are ways out for them, right? When you want to have a conscientious objector, they have like lawyers and people in place that can help military personnel sue basically for a discharge if they think that what's going on is against the Constitution or against their oath.
Yeah, I don't know about the organization, but it is a provision of life in the military that if you're given an order that it seems unconstitutional, you can refuse to obey it. I mean, in fact, that's a lot harder than it sounds, but it is a basis in fact, because even though you're supposed to be obeying the orders of the commander-in-chief, if those orders are in direct contradiction to the Constitution, there's an out. And I know many people in the military, because my husband was military, and they're just miserable with what's going on. I mean, I think that Trump is polluting every agency that there is, including the military, but I'm hopeful because I see so many people going kind of looping back into the voting thing, where I'm just amazed at the amount of young people and middle-aged people and military people and women and people of color who are coming into the system to run for office in response to this. And for people who think that the voting doesn't matter, I mean, first of all, I'm going to pull your pants down and spank you. Because I hear, my vote doesn't matter and all candidates are the same. And that kind of nonsense, false equivalency is just enraging. I don't happen to like a lot of the Democratic leadership. Hakeem Jeffries takes more money from AIPAC than almost anybody, And so, but I will tell you this, when the Democrats control the House and Senate, you don't see the defunding of the national parks. You don't see defunding of Planned Parenthood. You don't see people's rights being taken away. So whether or not I like all of them, they're a hell of a lot better than my old party, which is now marching in goose step to destroy everything we love about this country. So I hate false equivalency. I don't tolerate it. And also, I've noticed that the Democratic Party is truly much more diverse. I mean, you have everything from people who really are very far to the left, although very far to the left nowadays doesn't look very far to the left to me. And it's so ironic because you have a president who's taking over private industry and getting shares and a say at the board of U.S. Steel and of the microchip companies. That's socialism. State control of the means of production is actually the definition of socialism, not healthcare for everybody, which any other democracy has. I mean, 60% of Americans' bankruptcies at a personal or family level are due to one medical bill. I mean, it's a travesty. And your vote is incredibly important because I've been in so many races, literally, state Senate races that were won or lost by 40 votes. Al Gore lost to Bush by a handful of votes, a vote per precinct nationwide, by nothing, by 500 and some odd votes in Florida. I mean, most elections are incredibly close. And so you don't agree with the candidate on everything. We don't agree with each other on everything. And the standard a lot of voters put on, or non-voters, I'm not going to vote, they don't stand for what I stand for. Who stands for everything you stand for? Get some wiggle room going in your head. Pick the better of the candidates. There are wonderful candidates out there, wonderful. And so they need us to back them with contributions of money for the campaigns because they're expensive and with voting.
I think there's honestly two things on the table with this, and I will hold myself accountable here and say that I'm guilty of both. I think what it takes is, one, to educate yourself on everyone that's on the table, which takes a lot of work when, you know, we're all doing what we think are more important things than researching candidates. So we come down to, it's one of two parties. And then that's into the second point, which is the mess that trying to break the situation that we're in regarding a two-party system. In trying to break that paradigm created, I think, the mess of Trump 2.0. And I say that because I did sit in this studio with my comrades and say, if we want things to get better, it's going to have to get worse. And that means in the calling for voting for third party candidates or Democratic socialists or whoever, as we experiment. And so that's the other thing that I see on social media, which keeps coming into the conversation because that's where a lot of us spend a lot of time right now. And, you know, folks are like, well, those of you who not only didn't vote, but voted for a third party candidate, you know, you caused this. So even for people who want a better world, we're infighting because people voted. I told people, vote with your conscience, you know, and I did. And at the end of the day, that conscience was Kamala. I'm going to tell everybody here right now. I could tell you that I'm an anarchist all day long, but I did what I thought was my duty because we still exist in this two-party system to vote for the lesser of two evils. But how can we, oh Lord, we run out of time. How can we make a change if we're pigeonholed into the two-party system, which are both funded by AIPAC and oligarchs and, you know,
the two-party system has its issues, but believe me, parliamentary democracy with tons of parties has horror shows. There's much better ways to address that. California did it by having third party. You don't have to register as a Republican or a Democrat. You can register as whatever the hell you want, or like me, no party preference, and you're allowed to still vote in the primary elections. That's the way to go about it. Don't even worry about the two-party. It's a two-party system. But what you need to do is break it open so that during the primary elections, particularly, you can vote and you're not locked out. So the change is structural rather than, oh, we're going to demolish the two-party system. That's not going to happen. But once you open the door for third-party people like myself or no-party people to vote, you actually create the space so that people who choose to be registered as an independent or a Green Party person can actually run more easily.
Yeah.
So it's a structural way of accomplishing the very thing you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Helen, I'd love to have you back on. Would you be open to being a guest again? And we can
It would be my pleasure because we never actually did hit on the Arab American community that I worked with for so long, and would love to do that.
Yeah, let's do it soon. And I'd also like to talk about the book that you're working on. Mm. Could you just say really quickly something about that?
It's a book. There's been other books written about it. But in 1967, Israel attacked a USS Liberty, an American intelligence ship, in international waters and killed dozens of crew members and wounded about 174 others. And the ship's experience was basically thrown into the shadows. They were the most attacked ship in American maritime history, but their awards were given in secret with no press because they didn't want to embarrass Israel.
Yeah, I want to have you back, and I want to talk about how we got here and how Israel became the shadow government of the United States.
But yeah, the tail that wags the dog.
The tail that wags the dog. And maybe I'll have you in the basement tapes, and then you can use all of the fun words that you weren't able to.
Oh, okay.
And people, you can find all of the things about In the Cab Radio at In the Cab Radio at Linktree or Instagram. This show will be up in a couple of days, and you can catch the full conversation in our archives. Thank you so much for listening, Helen. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, my great pleasure.
I appreciate this time.
And the world, because I guess we stream worldwide.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. So thanks, everyone, for listening wherever you are. Love y'all. Stay up, and we'll talk again next week. In the Cab Radio is produced by Jada White, a.k.a. Dream Queen. Original theme music produced by Baby Weekend Boys and Icky Mac the Beat Jugular. Learn more at In the Cab Radio at Linktree. Thank you so much for tuning in.